You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and we want to start off by acknowledging the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. till 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Welcome to Tuesday Breakfast. It is Tuesday, the 10th of March, 2026, and we want to say thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. And on today's show, it's just myself, Juliet, and Julia here in the studio with you. How are you going today, Julia?
I'm not too bad.
Did you get up too much for the long weekend?
I actually worked yesterday, so casual rates.
Yes, which nice. Is good.
But otherwise, yeah, not too much. Just, I guess the weather was pretty nice. And, yeah, I went to Monslevat, actually, which is like an artist community,
yeah,
which is really
cool.
Nice on Sunday.
Yeah, I've never been there, but I've been meaning to go for quite a while. Yeah. It looks really tranquil out there.
It's really nice. Yeah, yeah. How about you? Did you get up too much?
Yeah, I had kind of a busy long weekend. I did a couple of day trips, so went up to the Dandenongs, which was really nice. Yeah, and then I did another trip up to Macedon. So
nice. Yeah. I love the Dandenongs.
Yeah, so nice. It's really gorgeous. And now I've got a dream. I want to ride Puffing Billy because I've never done it.
Yep, you should.
Yeah.
Yes. I used to go as like a kid sometimes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and you put your legs out.
Oh, that
no, no, that's what happens. Yeah. Oh, that's fun though. Yeah. I love it. The trees are so tall there as well.
They really are. Nice. Yeah, it's very stunning out there. Yeah, I did this hike where we just like walked up and down some big hills, which was very pretty. And the massive trees were like surrounding us, which was cool.
Yeah, some of those hikes can get abruptly like elevated.
I didn't really know what to expect for that one. And at some moments I was like, wow, this hill is never ending. It was really gorgeous. And today I think we've got a pretty big show for everyone ahead. First up we're going to be hearing from Inaz Janif, who's the former executive member of the Islamic Council of Victoria, who spoke recently at a recent public forum called Unite to Fight Racism, and that took place at the end of February at Trades Hall. Then what have we got at 7:30, Julia?
At 7:30, we have an interview with Rowena Howard, who is an artist and photographer who creates in response to nature.
Fantastic. And then at 7:45, we'll be listening to an excerpt from 3CR program Raise the Roof, which focuses on housing issues. And we're specifically going to hear from guest Margarita Windisch, who is a researcher from RMIT who investigates older women's experiences of heat waves in their homes. Then at 8 o'clock, we're going to be speaking to Bea from the Red Lantern Project at Vixen, and we're going to be chatting about what they've been working on so far this year and the upcoming Asian migrant sex workers and survivors of violence speak out. And it's going to take place at the State Library, so we'll hear more about that event later. And then finally at 8:15, Sandra Towers is a coordinating for Honk for Housing, the daily demonstration outside the high-rise public housing towers in Flemington. Sandra spoke to 3CR's Marion Cincotta on the end of December about the state government's destruction of public housing across NAM. So, yeah, that's what's coming up on today's show. And, first, our news headlines.
these are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 10th of March, 2026. The Victorian Aboriginal Child and Community Agency has welcomed the passage of amendments to the Children, Youth and Families Act by the Children, Youth and Families Amendment Stability Bill 2025 by Victoria's Parliament. VACCA said the reforms came following government consultation with the agency and other Aboriginal-controlled organisations who have seen firsthand the harmful impacts of this punitive legislative regime. VACCA Acting Chief Executive Megan Van Denberg said the changes provide greater flexibility and time for Aboriginal families to access the culturally appropriate, intensive and targeted supports that they need, ensuring children can be where they belong with their families and community. When you do the work with families and offer the right support, children go home. That is the ultimate aim, says Ms. Vandenberg. Also in the news, Human Rights Watch has found evidence Israel used white phosphorus in residential areas of southern Lebanon earlier this month in violation of international humanitarian law. In a new report released on Monday, the New York-based rights group said it confirmed the authenticity of 7 photos showing white phosphorus munitions fired over a residential area in southern Lebanon's Yarmouk, with fires breaking out in at least 2 homes on March 3rd. Ramzi Case, a Lebanon researcher with HRW, said the Israeli military's unlawful use of white phosphorus over residential areas is extremely alarming and will have dire consequences for civilians. The incendiary effects of white phosphorus can cause death or cruel injuries that result in lifelong suffering. The result of the use of airburst white phosphorus is unlawfully indiscriminate in populated areas and does not meet the requirement under international humanitarian law to take all feasible precautions to avoid civilian harm.
In other news, following the US and Israel's bombing of oil storage facilities in Iran, Iran's people have faced toxic black rainfall this past Sunday morning. The resulting rain, grey clouds and choke-inducing smoke pose a major environmental and humanitarian risk for Iranians. Tehran's 10 million residents have been urged to stay indoors by the Iranian government due to hazardous air quality. Asal Rad, fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., commented on the bombing. On top of everything else, Israel and the U.S. have unleashed an environmental disaster in Tehran. Ismail Bakay, the spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry, characterized the attacks as nothing less than intentional chemical warfare against the Iranian citizens and warned that it could be a dangerous new phase of the war. And finally, in headlines, a new report calls to ban strip searches in Australian prisons by all state and territory governments. The research, conducted by the Human Rights Law Centre and Flat Out, uncovered that strip searches are conducted on a regular basis at prisons but rarely reveal dangerous items, with a lack of evidence between strip searches and the detection of contraband. The report noted that strip searches breach human rights and are conducted despite the availability of alternative methods. Thousands of strip searches take place every month, including children who are made to strip by adult guards. In particular, the research highlighted the compounding harm caused by strip searches on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who face mass incarceration.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Women on the Line, we're about
feminisms in their multitudes,
First Nations sovereignty,
land back,
trans liberation, poo-poo on the turfs,
abolition,
anti-racism,
sex worker rights,
South liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonisation,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
The Commons Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Have a few children's picture books or footy boots that your kids have outgrown but want to find them a loving home? Well, drop them in at 3CR and put them in the Books and Boots bin. Books and Boots regularly sends pre-loved children's picture books and sports footwear to remote and regional First Nations communities and children across the country. Contact us at Books and Boots or go to the website www.booksandboots.org.au. We love a good book.
VCR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to 3CR, and first up on Tuesday Breakfast this morning, we will be hearing from Inaz Janif, who's the former executive member of the Islamic Council of Victoria, who spoke at a recent public forum titled Unite to Fight Racism. This event was held at Trades Hall on Wednesday, 25th of February, by the Refugee Action Collective, who brought together a panel of women to discuss their experiences, the racist scapegoating of migrant communities, and the ways we can help welcome refugees and asylum seekers moving forward. And just a brief warning for listeners that this following segment contains a description of Islamophobia and racism in action, that is, targeted violence against Muslim women in the community. If this raises concerns for you and you would like somebody to talk to, you can reach out to Lifeline 13 11 14. Here's the segment.
My name is Inaz Janif, as she said, but I'm going to start by beginning to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which we are meeting today. I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. I think I'm probably a little bit unknown to a lot of people, so I'd start by introducing who I am. I am someone who was born in New Zealand, but my parents migrated here when I was a baby. So I've grown up in the southeast of Melbourne. Obviously, I am visibly identifiable as a Muslim woman. So I'm an Australian Muslim woman. I'm of Fijian Indian background. And I'm a mother, a very proud mother of four. And that's why I'm here today. I am a public school teacher. I've been teaching maths and science and biology in the southeast of Melbourne for almost two decades. I'm sorry, it's a little bit overwhelming. I was just listening to Lydia and thinking about how I can relate to so much of what she said. I have been subjected to racism in my own life from a very young age. And I'm not normally this emotional, but it's just coming to terms with how common this is, and we normalize it. So I've been in public schools all my life. I grew up in a very white area, and I was probably one of three Indian brown-looking people in the whole school. And I remember from a young age being told that I'm yuck, that I'm dirty, that I'm ugly. I wasn't visibly identifiable as being Muslim, but I was excluded, I was pushed to the side, and I was made to feel like I don't belong because of the color of my skin. I remember telling my parents about this, and they, my mum, she married my father when she was 16. She had me when she was 19 years old, a very strong woman. And she said to me, tell them that their skin is like white paint. She was like, fight back. I remember somebody bullied me and took my pocket money for the canteen. And she went and spoke to the principal. He didn't act. She spoke to him again. He didn't act. And then one day she went over and she said, show me who that kid was. And she went and spoke to him and said, if you ever touch my daughter again, I think that's where I get my strength from. As I grew up and I went to my local public school, high school in Dandenong, I think that's where I finally felt like I belong. I was treated like I have value, and it didn't matter where you came from. And I think a lot of strength came from my teachers, and that's probably what led me to become a teacher myself. I love maths, I love science, and that's why I've stayed being a teacher while there's a teacher shortage, like Lydia said. I think that as part of my faith, we need to be very conscious and intentional about our decisions, what we do on a daily basis. So I thought, if I can do anything, why not teach? Why not help people who need it most? And that's why I've remained working in that area. As I grew up, my father and my community tried to build a mosque. And mosques are just like churches are a very central place where births are, you know, commemorated or marriages are celebrated, deaths and funerals are held. They're the hub of the community. But I noticed as my parents and my community tried to build that mosque, it took them probably 20-something years due to racism and Islamophobia in the local area. My father is the actual architect of Hallam Mosque, and he's the architect of the Romanian Orthodox Church right next door. So that's where I get my values from. I could work in a Muslim school. I am Muslim. I choose to be Muslim. I'm very strong in my beliefs and values, but I choose to help everyone. But that kind of sentiment is not extended to me and people like me. I grew up, you know, with pig's head at our door because my family dared to be part of an approach to build a place where we can congregate and build community and try and improve our society. We had death threats. We had phone calls. We had mail. I remember our parents tried to hide this information from us when calls would happen late at night, but we knew what was going on. As I got older, 9/11 happened. I was at university at Monash, and I was like an antibiotic. Wherever I'd go and sit in the lecture theatre, people get up and move away. And that happened all the time, and I had to make a conscious decision. What do I want to be? What is important to me? I'm a Muslim, and I'm going to be strong in that. And this is what I believe in. If people don't like it, so be it. This continued. I saw, as you know, time went on, people I know had their hijabs pulled off. I've had friends driving with their kids in the car driven off the road. I've had myself, you know, with my kids in the car being screamed at that, oh, you're a terrorist. And I've even witnessed young people that I teach being assaulted in public. I think that was the red flag for me. Enough is enough. We hear politicians, we hear lots of leaders in society often locate the root cause of our grievances as Muslims or Asians or Italians in the past or Greek people. Like I've been told by lots of people, oh, that's happened to us before. It's just your turn. But why are we continuing that? As someone who's 44 years old now, like, come on now. Enough is enough. Let's treat everybody with respect. We are all sacred. We are all important. Our lives have value and they have meaning. Doesn't matter whether we're here. Doesn't matter if you have a Greek background or whatever background you come from. Everyone deserves to live in peace and thrive with what they hold dear to them. Now, because of what I've been saying, the first time I actually started speaking about these experiences was right here 10 years ago. And it's funnily enough that I've been asked to come back here and speak again where it all began for me to speak up, because I'm actually an introvert. I hate standing. I hate attention. But I felt like this all happened to me for a reason. When I saw my students assaulted, when I see my mosques attacked, when I see fellow Muslims, you know, being, you know, having death threats and so on. Lydia talked about those death threats coming to Lekemba Mosque. This has just been continuing for so long. Just yesterday, a young 14-year-old girl had her hijab pulled off in Queensland in public by a stranger. So I'm a mum of four, and my eldest daughter is 15 now. And in November last year, while she was waiting to get picked up outside her public high school by her dad, someone drove past her and screamed at her that she's a terrorist. And then they stopped and they came out and they screamed at her again. And no matter, you know, all these last, you know, 15 years of me working against racism, against Islamophobia, it didn't save my own daughter. She chose to wear hijab, funnily enough, like 8 months before that happened. And she was too scared to tell me that this had happened to me, even though racism and Islamophobia is something we talk about often. So my question to you is, what are we going to do about this? Because it's not just my daughter who, you know, suffers from these incidents. I'm sure all the speakers can attest to examples like this, which is also located in how refugees are seen, perceived, talked about, and then acted against. Since when did refugee become a dirty word? So, I want to, because I'm a teacher, I'm going to say, I wish I could tell all of you to give yourself a pat on the back, because you bring me hope. You've taken out time out of your busy schedule midweek to come here and say that this matters to me. There's so many examples I could give you. I could talk about the impacts of racism. One thing that's not talked about is the health impacts of racism from before birth to death. Lydia touched on that. But racism impacts birth outcomes. It impacts children within the womb. And my last example that, you know, they talk about racism being a frog boiling analogy. We're in that hot pot and it's just getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And we don't realize how hot it is until we get those red flags. Another red flag for me was about a year and a half ago when two women had their hijabs pulled off and then they were strangled with it. That happened in Melbourne. And one of them was pregnant and it happened in front of her child. So I'm giving these examples to say that racism exists. It exists and manifests against Muslims. Muslims are the convenient political football right now because we are such a multicultural nation. And until we contend with how this nation came about, we're not terra nullius. Until we contend with the original origins of this land, then no change will come. So I ask you to keep doing what you're doing. Keep making this effort because step by step, drop by drop, you're making an impact. Our culture, our standards, and our values are built by all of us. You've made the choice to come here, and I'm sure that you're going to make the choice to continue your fight, our fight. It's all our fight. Thanks, everyone.
We've been listening to a speech from Inaz Janif, who spoke at the public forum Unite to Fight Racism, hosted by the Refugee Action Collective on Wednesday, 25th of February. To find out more of their events, you can look up Refugee Action Collective on social media or head to their website, rac-vic.org. And up next, we're going to listen to Don't Let the Kids Win by Julia Jacklin.
Don't let the kids win, just let them lose. They're not gonna learn anything if that's the way you choose to play. Don't let the kids win, just let them fall. You don't want them growing up thinking, see, your roads are good at playing basketball. Don't let your grandmother die while you're away. A cheap trip to Thailand's not gonna make up for never getting to say goodbye. And don't let your brother stop thinking you're cool. Yeah, I know he's got a girlfriend now and he's taller, but that don't mean he stopped looking up to you. And I've got a feeling that this won't ever change. We're gonna keep on getting older. It's gonna keep on feeling strange. Don't let your friends turn cold while you burn to green. When they walk off the stage, embrace them and say that's the best shit I've ever seen. And don't let your sister walk down the aisle without pulling her close, saying I love you and it's okay if I don't see you for a while. And I've got a feeling that this won't ever change. We're gonna keep on getting older. It's gonna keep on feeling strange. And don't let the time go.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and that was Don't Let the Kids Win by Julia Jacklin.
Today in the studio, we will be interviewing Rowena Howard. Rowena is a multidisciplinary artist who creates in response to native bushland, particularly inspired by the surrounds of her home in Kanamaluka country in northern Lutruwita. Her art invites us to pause, reflect, and honour the slow stillness that nature brings. Welcome to the studio today, Rowena.
Thank you.
Thank you. I feel very lucky to have you here today. I got to meet you outside your exhibition at Mons Labatt. I would love to know, could you tell me more about this exhibition and what it means to you and where your inspiration behind it comes from?
Yeah, so I've been living on about 10 acres of native bushland for the last year, and this is sort of a slow exploration of that place and trying to find my way into it. So it's got a lot of native stringy barks, and the trunks open up, and the insides have hollow parts. So that's a huge part of what the sculptures are about. And then the photograph element situates these sculptures in the place they were made. So, and then another element is the musical part, which was done in collaboration with a musician, Tasha Zappala, who I asked to come to the place where I live, and she came and did bird recordings and microbats and a little wrens beside the dam. And so all of that feeds into this site-responsive work.
That's awesome. Beautiful. Because nature can be like the best inspiration, I believe. And when did you sort of first feel that connection to nature?
That's a tough question.
Sorry.
I think it's always been there. When I was quite young, I used to take moss from the front yard of my house and bring it inside and fill up the potbelly stove, just put it on top when the fire was not going. So that was, really early interaction.
Nice.
But I think this exhibition is sort of about the way nature makes me feel, and hoping that I can convey that to other people and have that similar relaxed, calming, grounding energy that I get from being within the forest and the trees of the native bush.
Yeah, definitely. I think I really felt that translated in the exhibition. I think it brought this sense of reflection and peace, which is, something I think our world doesn't always allow, like the busyness of life.
Yeah, I think what I'm doing is to try to be an antithesis to that element that we have. I think so many people are disconnected from that, and having tactile elements to it and encouraging open doors and the wind coming through, it enables that inside outside slow way of connecting that is maybe more accessible to some people than just sitting in the middle of the bush. It becomes a gentle medium.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. And I suppose even for you, the creative process would be also, reflecting that as well. So could you tell me more about your creative process and the mediums that you use, or what's your favourite medium to use? I know you use a lot of secondhand materials, which I think is something really great and something...
So I came to art through photography, and this exhibition is using both what I started with in photography, but then incorporating it into installation. So I went to art school at UTAS, and that
enabled me to start working with plant-dyed fabrics and from there moving into sculptural forms. So I use a lot of recycled and secondhand materials wherever I can, if it's possible. I don't like to buy new things. I think there's so much already in the world that we can use and repurpose. And the process of boiling the fabrics and imprinting leaves on them is always a multi-day process. So sitting with the fabrics and boiling all the leaves in the water is something that's a lovely thing to do, and it means I can just spend the day keeping an eye on the pot and filling up the water. And similarly with the stitching process, that's all very, to make the sculptures, each element is slow, gradual exploration of the materials and seeing how they best want to be reformed. So each little fold and nuance of the materials slowly builds up and just organically becomes a form, a new form.
Wow, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. I particularly loved, yeah, the tree statues. They're really beautiful. I'll have to put a photo in the podcast of them. Do you have any inspirations when it comes to creating art, or anyone that sort of has inspired you along the way?
Yeah, for sure. Selena de Carvalho has been a long time influence, even before I knew who she was. She has finished her PhD a few years ago, and her studio looked onto the street. So at UTAS, when I would walk past, she would do installations, and I kept wondering who it was. And my supervisor, Martin Walsh, he told me who she was, and that was great to start following her. Katie West as well, she was around Nam for a little while, and she did some beautiful, gentle, soft, spacious installations, also using plant-dyed fabrics. And the writing of David Abram as well has been really influential in being a central tactile. He has a lot of philosophy, but it's about being in the present and exploring the senses through tactility.
Yeah, nice. That's great. I think, being present is something, so important, and something we don't necessarily always think about. And, one thing I think that's great about your exhibition is that I got to meet you there. I guess I'd love to know, about the experience of being on site at the exhibition and allowing people to, have a chat and give you that feedback with your art.
Yeah, it's been really great. I'm thankful to Olivia Morris at Montsalvat, who has encouraged the different forms of participation, but whichever we feel most comfortable with. And so she's been really instrumental in just asking us to interact in whatever way we feel comfortable. So for me, it's just making a space under the Chinese elm, close to the exhibition, but not right within it. So that enables visitors to come and say hi or have a chat, and it can be just a quick one sentence, or one artist I met earlier in the week, we ended up talking for 3 hours, and it's just that space where people can feel comfortable to come and go, I think is really important, and not pushing anything. So it's been so helpful just understanding people's experiences and feeling like they can come and speak without any pressure or expectation. Mm. So I think that's also important in what I'm doing, just to make people feel comfortable.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Mm. Yeah, because it's very human as well to like talk with you and even read the journal that you put out and the comments about creation and how creating can be frustrating. And it's not always going to be this, yeah, like very like flowy process. It has its ups and downs, which is good to know because that's like, well, that's the reality of creating.
I think, yeah, it's the journal explores my mental process through residency, which I did in Launceston last year. So that started with the residency and it has continued to the culmination of the exhibition. So it charts a lot of that journey. And for me, journaling helps to contextualize everything. Every newsletter or book or podcast that I'm listening to, all the little pieces of information and quotes all go into the journal, and photographs of work that in progress, all of that's a helpful part of the process that I love to look back on. And over the years, the same name or the same idea keeps coming back, and you can chart that progress. And it's an instrumental part of the process for sure.
It's awesome. I also just wanted to ask, so how do you recommend that people in general, in your opinion, begin reconnecting with nature and slow down in their lives and sort of allow for that in their life?
I think giving yourself a daily practice in whatever form that looks like. It might be that you just sit with some indoor plants to start with and just really pay attention to them and tune out from everything else that's around you. Turn off your phone and turn off the sound and just be with it. But I think going for a walk in any space that you can, that's maybe it's preferable to move away from a city park where there are cars and distractions around, but like the Merri Creek is just so close to here, and that's what Katie West would use for her inspiration when she was living in so I think, yeah, that daily practice is key, and it doesn't need to be a long time. It just needs to be regular. It might be 5 minutes a day, but to really sit with that and make that commitment to yourself is really important, I think.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It's definitely like, yeah, a commitment and a relationship that we have to choose, I think. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. And I also want to ask you, for our listeners, what's the best way we can witness more of your artistic work and find out more about you?
Anyway. So I'm on Instagram, grounded.stitching. I'm starting a mailing list in the coming months. That's my next project. So I think for me, that's a way to connect more personally. I feel Instagram is quite a different platform, but it's a place that people can feel they can connect publicly. I also have a Facebook, which I'm just feeling into at the moment, slowly. It's a new platform for me. Yeah, I think they're great starting points. The exhibition is on at Montsalvat until the 29th of March, and I'll be sitting there again from the 25th. Each day from midday till 4:00. So if people want to come and say hi, I would love to meet you. And yeah, any way you can interact is totally welcome.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing with us.
Thanks so much, Julia. It's been such a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you. Me too. We've been speaking with Rowena Howard, an artist who creates art in tribute and harmony with nature, particularly honouring Kanamaluka country in northern Lutruwita. You can catch her art exhibition on right now at the Montsalvat Artist Community. You're listening to 3CR Radio. And next we will be playing a song by Tasha Zapala. The song is called Weaving and includes field recordings from Kanamaluka country, capturing the summer, dusk, evening and dawn. The soundscape was completed as a part of the exhibition by Rowena Howard. Thank you.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and that was Tasha Sapala's song Weaving. Next, we'll listen to an excerpt from Raise the Roof, which is presented by the Housing Action Group. And in this clip from the 28th of January show, Fiona and Liz speak to Margarita Windisch, a researcher from RMIT who looks into older women's experience of heat waves in their homes. And here we hear from some of the individual stories that Marguerite has uncovered through her research and also covers the effectiveness of public cool spaces.
We're joined in the studio today by Margarita Windisch, who is a researcher from RMIT. How are you going today?
I'm good.
That's great.
One of the high rises, you know, and not leave, which was three different fans in different.
DigiChew, People, Place, Language. Connecting stories, culture, and language across Australia. Contribute your content in digitube.com.au. Sign up for a free account and select your options for streaming, download, and broadcast promotion.
A 3CR supporter.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In NAM, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
We're joined in the studio.
Can you tell us a bit about some of their housing conditions and, what did you tell us about the individuals?
Yeah, look, I have a particular, like one of the particular stories that was really very impactful for me. And she was actually the first person I interviewed. She lived, you know, alone in her own flat. She was an owner-occupier. Mid-80s, she said, I'm in my golden years, which was really lovely, but she didn't tell me more than that. Mid-80s, lived by herself, very, very small budget, yeah, an aged care pension. And she told me this story. She had no air conditioning. She had a tree in the past that was providing her shade for her bedroom that was cut down without any kind of conversations. And she said it was a few days, was really, really hot, and she was lying on her bed and she could not breathe anymore. And she said, I left my house, it was 11:30 at night, and I went to the train station, which wasn't far away, to sit there a little bit out, you know, in the kind of warm air. But the warm air was less hot than her flat. And the PSOs or protective services officers came up and said, lady, are you all right? And she said, I'm a bit better here than at home. And that was really quite striking for me, because I was thinking, here is a woman in her mid-80s who has to leave her home to go out and sit at the train station because that was safer than in her flat. That was quite phenomenal.
Yeah.
Another story was of a woman who lived in one of the high rises, you know, for public housing for people who are 55 plus. She lived on one of the top floors and no air conditioning either. And the windows only open a little bit. There was no real airflow, no fans, like ceiling fans, they can't put them in. And those big housing towers, on the top it gets really hot and there's radiating heat and it's west-facing. Mm-hmm. And she told me the intricate steps she had to take in how she could manage to stay in her flat and not leave, which was three different fans in different directions, a sheet over here on that room. In the kitchen, she had to do this. She took about three or four showers. She tried to put some ice cubes on herself, and she was sleeping on the floor in a small little mattress in the kitchen because that was the coolest place for her.
It's so much management. It's a lot of labour. It's a lot of invisible labour, again, as women, invisible labour is what we seem to have to do. But very difficult, so much management,
yep.
Like trying to create her own microclimate.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why that kind of the second act of protection, I kind of call it also, you know, labouring at the intersection of age, of gender and class. And the poorer the women were and the less power they had over, you know, their own kind of living conditions, the more labour they had to perform. Mm,
yeah.
And I think that brings us back again to, you know, heat waves, and we know direct outcomes now of climate change or climate breakdown, which has been fueled by, you know, a completely rapacious system, as I've outlined before. These women are the least responsible for this situation, but are the ones who basically have to do so much labour in order to survive it. So, and I think that was a really big one, and there was lots of stories of the amount of labour women have to do, or they have to think ahead of changing their little social life schedules and stuff, every medical appointment, because they don't want to go outside in the heat. A lot of these women weren't driving. That's the other thing, you know. They were women from, you know, 65 to 90. And the big cohort, especially in, you know, 75 plus, don't have a driver's license. So they had to restructure so much, you know, of what they were doing. And one of the women also, like her big thing was also when two crises collide. So you have the climate crisis, yeah, with the heat waves, and with COVID-19 and the emergency measures. And she was saying too that, you know, because she couldn't even leave the house, she might have maybe wanted to go to a shopping centre, but you weren't allowed to congregate. So she said that the isolation was actually the worst factor for her. That social isolation, she said, I call it murder. They were her words, you know. And I think in a way what that shows us again too, that heat doesn't just have an impact on your physical well-being, which a lot of women talked about. You know, they felt completely exhausted. They got headaches. They felt emotionally drained. Their mental health deteriorated. Mm. They got depressed because they felt locked in, you know. So the impact on the person, the body, is very broad, so to speak. And we already know that for people living alone, they often feel isolated, yeah, especially older people. We know that's one of the biggest risk factors of dying earlier too, social isolation. So when then you have, you know, a heat wave, which is a crisis, you can say, plus then another one on top of it, it had a very big impact on a few women, and they mentioned that factor quite a lot.
Mm. A lot of the advice that we hear during heat waves is very much things that the individual should be doing. So, you know, keeping yourself cool, go to a cool spot, as you're saying, go to a shopping centre, go to a library. So with that advice sometimes being quite focused on the individual behaviours, in what ways do you think that is flawed, and how does that kind of not work?
Look, I think what I also, of course, found is that these are women with an incredible amount of experience. Then they bring their practice wisdom in. They bring, you know, some of them talked and said, air conditioners didn't even exist until I was 60. You know, nobody had them and whatever, you know. So they brought in their own practice wisdom in what do you do when you know it's getting hot. And so they had very, you know, what do you say, from their experience, you know, the clothing, they do this, they do that, like very intricate things to keep cool. But that often wasn't enough anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think what was very striking for me, because I also initially came in and thought, oh, yeah, public cool places, that's what we need. and I still believe we need them. Yeah. And I just thought, wow, this is fantastic. And, you know, for older women to access public cool places, they can be cool in a couple of different ways, like keep you cool and safe, but also hang out, connect and do all of that.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and that was a segment from Raise the Roof featuring guest Margarita Windisch, who shared the findings of her research into the effect of heat waves on older women in their homes and the viability of public cool spaces as a solution to those challenges.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and now we're speaking to Bea, who leads the Red Lantern Project at Vixen. They do outreach and support work and advocate for sex workers and are one of the co-founders of Justice for Our Sisters, a collective of Asian and Asian migrant sex workers in NAM. And today, Bea joins us to discuss what's happening at Vixen in 2026 and the upcoming Asian migrant sex workers and sex worker survivors of violence speak out, which is taking place at the State Library of Victoria this week. And Bea is here to discuss the reason behind the speak out and how March is a heavy time of year for the sex worker community. Welcome back to Tuesday Breakfast, Bea.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. We last spoke to you, I think, back in September. I was wondering, what have you been up to in the first 3 months of 2026 in your role at Vixen?
Yeah, I think the first 2 months of 2026, you know, I feel like it's already been busy already. Absolutely, I've been, you know, still continuing doing outreach, advocacy and support, you know, work with Asian migrant sex worker, especially during last year that we have been a lot of raids that happened in, you know, within Asian migrant sex worker community. And also like still doing events, for example. Last month, we have a Lunar New Year. We have the sex worker, Asian migrant sex worker gathering together and also, you know, plan and do outreach to give out the red pocket to our Asian massage parlor and brothels. And I think, for example, yesterday I just, you know, went to visit workplaces because we, unfortunately, we just received, you know, the raid that happened last month, and also last week as well. So, yeah, it's been already busy in my path.
Yeah, it sounds like a very busy start to the year, and I'm really sorry to hear about the raids that have been happening. And yeah, unfortunately, that seems to be a continuation of what was happening last year. And I know that March is a very difficult time for the Asian migrant sex worker community. For those who might not know, could you tell us a bit about how the community has been targeted by the Australian Border Force raids?
You know, March has been, you're right, like, it's been difficult times for us during this month. I think it's two parts. First part is about, you know, upcoming court hearings for our three sisters, which are Yushi Bo, Yun Suk Jung, and Yugo, who were murdered like in 2022 and 2024, which the next court hearing is this month, which one is like the 16th of March and another one 18th of March. So that will be the important court hearing connected with these cases. And as a community, you know, we're still grieving, and we also like still fighting for justice at the same time as well. And the second part is about the raids, you know, by Australian Border Force, which over the past few years we have seen increasing raids, which is heavily targeted to Asian migrant sex workers and workers of colour. So, for example, from the report that we've been received from the community last year alone, it's at least 20 workplaces were raided, you know, and those raids are often based on the racist stereotype about the Asian migrant sex workers, that assumption that we must be forced to work or we've been trafficked because of like who we are, because of we Asian, because of we migrant. And it's really strong anti-immigrant elements to these actions. And basically when Border Force, you know, raid, they just like come and check in people visa identification and cancelling visa. So this is, you know, the sense of the surveillance for all of us. And imagine, like, we've seen the news on the ICE in US. And I just want to say, like, in through my work, it's actually already happening here.
Yeah, it's really worrying to think about. And, yeah, I think a lot of the community wouldn't know that, what we're seeing in the US is already happening here in Australia for sex workers. So, yeah, thank you for sharing. And I know this Saturday, 14th of March, the Asian Migrant Sex Workers and Survivors are organising a speak out. Can you tell us a bit about this event?
Yeah, definitely. As I mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of things has been happening in our community. And also March last year, that what, you know, we've seen the raid started. And we've seen that the raid started last year in March, and how the Border Force came into the workplace twice in 1 week. And it's actually really surprising me that when I received the raid last week and I went yesterday, it's pretty similar thing that happening. So I think, you know, when plus the court case, I think that is why the behind of this gathering is needs to be happen, you know? And this I believe that, you know, to create the change, we need to bring people together between a sex worker, Asian migrant sex worker, survival, and also all allies, to come together to create a space that where Asian migrant sex worker voice to be heard. Because it's often that, you know, we have been silenced and we live in this colonial and racist system. It's most of the time our voice has been ignored. Yeah, this gathering that is going to be like really important, and yes, we take place this Saturday, and yeah, we have the speak out, and we have the lantern making at 3 o'clock as well before the speak out happen. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Bea. And yeah, we definitely encourage people to come along and support the event. And I know, yeah, you mentioned that there's 2 court hearings taking place next week. What do you anticipate, will happen during the hearings?
Yeah. So there are 2 upcoming court hearings taking place the following weeks, 16 and 18. So, on the 16th, there will be appeal hearing at the Supreme Court regarding the case involving of Yu Shibo and Yun Suk Jung, so where the court will review the previous manslaughter order outcome. And then the 18th, there will be committal hearing for the case of Yu Go at the Melbourne Magistrates Court. So for our community, you know, these hearings are very significant. We will definitely continue to show up and stand together in solidarity with our 3 sisters. You know, we you know, our project Rising Red Lantern, Big Sense, Southside Justice, which is the sex worker recall program, where we'll gather outside and with the community as well in the morning, which usually what we has been doing with the Hugo case. So we're going to hang the lantern, red lantern outside. And the lantern that we hang is made, is a handmade from the community. So each lantern is represent each of us who's standing with this court case. And we want to make sure that, you know, our three sisters is not going through this court case alone.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing the meaning behind the lanterns. And yeah, I think that's so special to have that, to make it as a community to represent, each individual and to come together in that act as well. And maybe to finish up, could you share, Bea, how 3CR listeners can support the work of the Asian and migrant sex worker community at Vixen?
Yeah. I think Teresa has been, you know, already like been supporting, and also like the community who listen to Teresa as well, like has been like really good supporting our allies, because the mainstream media not really, you know, supporting our side as much. Most of the time, like using the lens of perpetrator or the killer or the government, you know, or the anti-immigrant. So I think, I believe everyone of us have the power in this, so please share and please continue to join, please continue to support Rising Red Lantern Project and try to challenge this system together by, you know, like if someone talk about Asian migrant sex worker and say like, oh, are they trafficked or are they exploited, not or as a whole, and like we try to challenge together, like bring the strength of the Asian migrant sex worker and bring the, you know, our life and value, actually, like we are as equal as other, and that is how we're going to challenge the justice system, that to see us and to fight for justice for all the Asian migrant sex worker and all the sex worker.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bea, and I think that's such an important message to finish on, and we really appreciate you coming on air and sharing your perspective, and good luck for the Speak Out this week.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you. We've been speaking to Bea from the Red Lantern Project at Vixen about what they've been working on this year and the upcoming Asian migrant sex workers and sex worker survivors of violence Speak Out taking place this week. And if you are a migrant sex worker in need of support, you can reach out to your local peer organisation, and that's Scarlet Alliance for the Peak Body at scarletalliance.org.au or Vixen in so-called Victoria at www.vixen.org.au. Now, if you need to talk to someone about the issue covered in today's interview, you can also contact QLife on 1800 184 527 or go to qlife.org.au.
Do you work in a brothel, massage shop, escort agency, fetish house or dungeon, cam studio or porn set, sauna, short-time hotel, outdoors or on the street, or in any other space where sex work happens? Recent changes to Victorian sex work laws mean that sex workers now have more options for how and where we can work and who we can work with.
To find out more about Victoria's new sex work laws, contact Vixen, Victoria's statewide peer-only sex work organisation, 100% by and for all sex workers, on 039-070-9050.
And talk to another sex worker about what the partial decriminalisation of sex work means for you, your workplace and your community. Or check out the Decrim Info Hub at vixen.org.au. Vixen is a 3CR supporter.
Following former Premier Daniel Andrews' announcement to demolish the high-rise public housing towers in Victoria as part of a so-called upgrade, there has been significant pushback from displaced residents and other community members, either on-site, in the streets, or in the Supreme Court. Dr. Rachel I. M. Poliski is an urban
geographer and long-term contributing member of the Save Public Housing Collective, who has been pursuing a heritage listing of some of the 44 public housing estates. Here is part of her conversation with Danielle from 3CR's Breadline about some of the estate's unique history in the landscape of Melbourne.
Please, if you could tell us about the historical significance of the overall program that built the 44 towers.
So the towers are a product of a period of Victoria's policy history that I would argue is really unprecedented, right? And so they were built by the Housing Commission of Victoria, which no longer exists. But at the time, they were like one of the most prolific builders in Victoria's history. And so it was a product of the slum reclamation program. And so there was this sort of reformist era activists who were sort of arguing that the inner city living conditions for the poor were not working, and they pushed for these slum reclamation programs, and the Housing Commission of Victoria quickly came in, and they, you know, were initially building low rise and low density housing. But at the time in Europe, happening in parallel was,
did you say what year that was? Or approximate year 50s, period?
Late 50s. And then in the sort of early 60s, you know, the Housing Commission was really trying to find ways to economise money and land, and they were looking at what was happening in Europe, and they were building so much of these big estates, and they sent a bunch of their architects, the Housing Commission of Victoria's architects, over to Europe on study tours, and they went, did a bunch of study tours, came back, and were like, no, we need to build high, we need to build density, we need to build with concrete, and they moved to the model that led to the towers we have today. And the towers are also really unique in that they are prefabricated concrete structures. And so they were and this was the first time the government had experimented with prefabricated building and construction. And they built them at a factory in Holmes Glen that the government ended up purchasing and turning exclusively into prefabricating for the Housing Commission's program. And actually the factory still stands, I believe it's heritage listed actually, but to fact check me on that one. And so yeah, so they built them, they were prefabricated and then came to site, built them like a house of cards, and they built these tremendous towers, and they built like they've never built before. I mean, the amount that got built particularly in the 60s, in that 10 years when the Housing Commission was really, really active across the inner city was, you know, truly unprecedented. They've never built that much before, and they've never built that much since. And it really signaled a significant moment in Victoria's housing and social policy history, in that they really thought we need to build high and we need to prevent urban sprawl. That was the strategy at the time.
Just on that, because it sounds like historically it's relevant for the government to be proud of what occurred.
Totally.
And historically it's something as a state we should be proud of what we did, but it's like erasure of
totally.
So it's kind of gross. But also another question is, each state, like obviously around Fitzroy it was slums, and what were the other ones, like Carlton and
North Melbourne,
Flemington, was it these slum areas as well, or they're different kind of social heritage stuff?
Yeah, North Melbourne was actually the largest slum declaration area. And listen, you know, history has the telling of the history of the slum reclamation program has taken some turns. It was originally seen as this really great thing the government did, and you know, there's increasingly recognition that some of it was probably just a land grab and not all of it was truly slum. And you know, and so maybe, and ironically, there is a bit of history repeating itself with the government's agenda to demolish today. But
sorry,
oh no, go ahead.
Previously, the government was land grabbing for themselves for government ownership, and now they seem to be land grabbing on behalf of corporations and property developers?
Yes, well, you're right. That is a major distinction. So I shouldn't compare them just like that. But no, that's true. But look, wherever you stand on the slum reclamation element, because that is a contentious history at best, you can't deny just how much they built. And it really was at the time not just considered for quote unquote the urban poor, like it was also accessible to what was considered middle class at the time. And it was particularly North Melbourne was designed with families, and there was this big push to develop for lone older persons was the technical language at the time. And even at the time, the biggest and fastest growing demographic of people needing social public housing was older single women, which is still the trend today. Yeah. That hasn't changed. You know, particularly post-war, they were, you know, suddenly widowed and needing support. And so they built these programs specifically for lone older persons, particularly women. And for migrants, we had a huge migration boom at the time. And this was built to house that. And so, you know, really, like, to go to your point, like, I think as a Victorian, we should be so proud of that history. Yeah. And then simultaneously so ashamed of the present and the erasure of that history.
Yeah. And also, I guess the other thing that we should be really ashamed of now is that things haven't changed enough. In fact, they've got worse for, you know, single women and older lone people, people with disabilities, all the people who should be on the housing list. And at that time, they were like literally expanding this opportunity to the middle class. So it was actually really progressive as a government. And now, look, we're going backwards, aren't we?
Yeah, no, I agree. And look, and they were also building, they were experimenting at the time also with suburban, like single dwelling builds, and that was designed to be like carry less stigma at the time. Mm. And then when they moved to high density, right, and at the time that the commission, just before the commission dissolved, the Housing Commission, it was really only doing high density towards the end. And there was still a little bit of stigma around this, around high density and inner city. Whereas, you know, I guess a bit more of the attitude was the middle class people that were being put into public housing were more moving out into the suburbs, and the inner city was saved more for, you know, recent migrants and whatever. But there was a real push to change that attitude and to make the buildings really modern, and to and particularly through the landscaping and the communal areas, they were really designed to create more of like a vertical community, and make these sort of like not resort, but you know, really appealing places to live that have, you know, all the amenity in one spot. And I think it was working towards the end. Like there was a real attitude shift just before the commission disbanded.
Well, sounds like it's worked that a range of different people on different incomes want to live in the inner city now. Yeah. So technically it's worked.
Yes. It was one of the most successful gentrification bits. Yeah.
Thanks for that. I guess the only other thing that comes up for me is that's at least 40 years, the 1950s, before superannuation was compulsory. Mm. So that's it would have been a necessity to have the elderly and single parents, mothers mostly, in make sure they had a roof over their head that wasn't a shanty.
Totally. Yeah. And that, I think that's why it's like doubly insulting that there's this distinct attack right now on older person units. Mm. When, you know, I think Victoria was the first state to have a dedicated program just for older persons, let alone one of that scale. Like that was a really significant program at the time. It was really groundbreaking and to this day still unprecedented. Like we've still not done it the way we did it then. And so to just do this sort of wholesale attack on all of those estates, or nearly all of them are in tranche three, I think is really disgraceful, because it's sort of like not only for the people living there that are directly affected, but it's also spitting on what is a really significant part of Victoria's history that we should be proud of. Like we should have that recognized.
Yeah. And it should be expanded rather than people who want to have no option but to live in a caravan.
And that was Danielle from 3CR's Breadline speaking with urban geographer and member of State Public Housing Collective. Next week on Tuesday Breakfast, we'll hear more from Rachel about the finer details of heritage listing and how the campaign is going to do and what the campaign is going to do for the towers. Listeners can contact Rachel to put in an application and be supported as someone with a vested interest in any of the towers in Tranche 2 and 3.
And can email Rachel, which we will put all the info in our podcast show notes at 3cr.org.au.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and that was She Oak by Alice Skye, who is a Wagaya Wemba Wemba woman and singer-songwriter. And finally, we've got our events calendar for the week. So tomorrow, Wednesday, 11th of March at 12 midday, is the Nationwide Strike for Palestine taking place at the State Library of Victoria. Then on Thursday, 12th of March at 5:30 p.m, there's 20 years of Camp Sovereignty, which is taking place at Camp Sovereignty. And then finally on Saturday, 14th of March at 3 p.m, we've got the Asian Migrant Sex Worker and Sex Worker Survivors of Violence Speak Out. So come at 3 o'clock for lantern making and 4:30 for the Speak Out itself. And both of those parts are taking place at the State Library. But yeah, I think that's about all we've got time for this morning on 3CR Breakfast. Thank you everyone for listening, and we'll just do a quick rundown of what we heard on the show. So at 7:15 we heard from Inaz Janif, who was formerly part of the Islamic Council of Victoria, who spoke at a recent public forum, Unite to Fight Racism, and she spoke about the need to welcome refugees and asylum seekers and spoke of her experiences of Islamophobia.
At 7:30, we spoke with Rowena Howard, who is presenting an art exhibition at Mons Lavat, and spoke to us about her process of creating Inspired by Nature.
And then at 7:45, we heard from Margarita Windisch speaking on the program Raise the Roof about her research into older women's experiences of heat waves. At 8 o'clock, we spoke to Bea from Red Lantern, speaking about the upcoming Speak Out and the broader work of what they do at Vixen. And finally, at 8:15, we heard from Danielle speaking on Breadline, who is an urban geographer and member of the Save Public Housing Collective.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.